Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain. And once more, and it's getting a bit boring really, I'm joined by Peter Hart.
Joined at the hip, I'm afraid.
Well, there's worse places to be joined to you. Oh, God.
Right.
Now, what are we doing today, Pete?
Well, we're doing a second fife and forfa.
Fife and forfa.
Oh. However you pronounce it. A fine body of men, I think we'll leave it at. And we're talking about their advance through France into Belgium. So this is pretty well August 1944 we're on about now. And where had we left them? We left them with a cliffhanger, which of course is a complete, like most cliffhangers, is a non sequitur sausage, because we're not going to talk about that at all, because they have nothing to do with the Falaise Gap, the 5-4-5 Yeomanry. So we'll mention it in passing. So what's happened to the 5-4-5 Yeomanry? Where are we? What are they doing?
Well, you're quite right. It is August. And on the 12th of August, 1944, after a rest period out of the line, the 11th Armoured Division,
fine body of men,
which they were part of, was sent to relieve the 15th Scottish Division in the Lassie region.
Where's that, Gary?
France. Meanwhile, great things had been underway The American Third Army had switched its line of attack to push north from Le Mans to Alençon, which was taken on 12th of August, before pushing on to Argentan.
Now, something else is happening, Gary, because from the 14th of August, Operation Tractable.
Hang on, how come you get Tractable and I get Alençon?
Now, what happened? Operation Tractable is the 1st Canadian Army and 1st Polish Armoured Division are trying to smash through determined German resistance in the Falaise area. What's Montgomery's overall intention? Gary, you're an expert on this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, his intent was absolutely clear: to trap the German 7th Army in Normandy by cutting their line of retreat to the east. The cliffhanger, as you've referred to, from the Operation Bluecoat episode was...
Could they do it?
Well, let's find out.
Bit of a disappointment for everyone because, as usual, the men of the 2nd 5-4-5 Yeomanry are totally unaware of the larger picture. And this is the truth in war generally. I think it's a point we can't make too often. Let's make it again. Nobody knows what's happening.
Now, at this stage, the method of advance could often be roughly summed up as two up, one in support. Thus, the armoured brigade would have two regiments leading with one in support. Each of the regiments would have two squadrons pushing forward and one squadron in support.
Now, mostly, because of the nature of the country, the Bocage, they had to use the roads, travelling forwards on parallel roads, separated normally a couple of miles apart, but heading in the same general direction. So if you put your fingers in front of you and move them forward, sort of that's what it would look like from the air.
My hand?
Yeah, no, your hand
is hairy and wrinkly.
And stubby, little tiny stubby fingers. Yes. Anyway, on 14th of August, the 2nd 544 Yeomanry moved back into action. They're advancing towards La Roque and ultimately heading towards Vassy. And wireless operator Jack Edwards, who we've encountered before, he's in a tank commanded by the newly promoted Corporal Pat Ketteridge. And you're going to be Jack Edwards, 4 Troop B Squadron. What do you got to say for yourself, Jack?
We set off along the road, Mr. Dark leading. We were second tank. As we were going along, I could see in the fields to the side of us our dead men from the 15th Scottish, still lying about from the recent operations. Another half mile or so, and there was a couple of knocked out Churchill tanks and some more of our dead lying about. It used to give me funny feelings seeing our dead. I used to cast my mind back to the moment when they were shot down and think, what would they be thinking at the time?
Yeah, that's quite. I find that an interesting and quite touching quote. Now, as the 5 and 4 approach the village of La Roque, there's a great deal of trouble with some German anti-tank guns. And eventually, it was decided to send a squadron to sweep round the left flank of the La Roque crossroads. And this was successful. So they surprised the German anti-tank gunners, and they capture some 40 prisoners. But this is a terrible quote that I'm going to do now. For a change, I'm going to, because you've got to switch it about. Can I be Pinky?
Yes, you can be Pinky. And you are going to tell us what Major Douglas Pinky Hutchison of A Squadron says.
And this is just awful. And this is the reality of it, isn't it, Gary? Sergeant Gale's tank was knocked out by either a self-propelled gun or tank, which then withdrew. We recovered his tank and towed it into the lager. It was burnt out. All the crew in the turret had been killed. I was upset about Gale because he was such a quiet, unobtrusive fellow, but thoroughly effective. Somebody I liked and respected. I had to take his charred remains out of the turret and bury them. And this is scraping things out, and it's awful. Because remember, the tanks are used again. They repair the tanks, put them back into action. But think of those poor, all the crew in the turret have been killed. So that's the commander, the loader, wireless operator and the gunner dead. And Hutchison, he may have been landed gentry and a somewhat amusing figure in a sense, but that's what he had the guts to do, go in there and clear out the tank.
Now, as the Germans retreated, they left plenty of signs of their passing. The country was literally littered with debris. And this is what Trooper John Buchanan of 4 Troop A Squadron says. There were dead horses, hundreds and hundreds of soft vehicles and trucks, mostly horse-drawn vehicles, the odd tank. All their armoured stuff got away. The stuff that we were wanting, they got away. Smoke, everything was on fire. Dead bodies, dead horses, cattle dead or dying all over the place. The legs were sticking up and blowing up like balloons. Oh, the smell. If you had inadvertently hit one with a tank track, it released the gases and the smell. They talk about skunks, but oh, Jesus. You had to have bags of water to try and wash it off or wait for a rainy day. You had to be very careful you avoided going over dead horses or people for that matter. The roads had to be kept clear, so they just had got one of these bulldozers up and shoved them off the road, dead, dying or wounded.
It's another terrible quote, but sadly...
Very graphic.
It is, but in my mind there came a certain old friend of ours as we were listening to the tale of the appalling stench released by the dead horses and cows. What came to your mind?
Nothing.
Not Fred?
No, he never smelt.
Fred never farted.
No. Now,
are you looking at Fred through rose-tinted spectacles?
I might be. The advance continued, and on the 17th of August, they reached the Ruy River, just to the east of La Carnelle.
You're getting all the good ones today.
I am.
Now, after a wreck, it was decided, and this next bit is just an amazing series of interlinked quotes, which I hope you enjoy, readers, listeners, or whatever you are, because after they decide they could get across the river. They use a scissors bridge. That's a sort of portable bridge. It's brought forward, dropped across. And at about 1800 on the 17th of August, two troops of A Squadron are sent forward with a company of the 3rd Monmouth. Now, with them is wireless operator Jack Edwards and driver Cliff Pember, and they've changed. It's not Ketteridge anymore. It's they've got a new commander in the tank. And who is it?
It's Lieutenant Alexander Munro, who was, as you mentioned, a recent reinforcement from the Lothians and Border Horse.
Now, once they're across the river, they move forward to support the infantry. And once again, you're going to be Trooper Jack Edwards, 4 Troop B Squadron.
The infantry were being mortared and we were told to advance, and we did. We'd done about 400 yards. Lieutenant Munro was in command and he headed towards a gap in a hedge. There was a big explosion in front of us, so he backed us off a bit, and then he machine gunned the hedge on both sides of the gap. He went further along the hedge to the left. Then he started moving towards the hedge again, but a voice, I don't know whether it was a troop leader or some other officer, warned him that he was getting too near the hedge. He ought to come away from that hedge. He started reversing. You can only reverse slowly. We were sort of at an angle, so we weren't getting very far away.
Now, by this time, most of the experienced members, remember he's new, of his crew, are getting worried. They're coming under mortar fire, and there's a serious risk, Gary, a Panzerfaust, that bazooka, as you would call it, with your American tastes, coming from there. I mean, they could be anywhere in that bloody hedge, couldn't they? And I'm going to be the driver who was Cliff Pember, obviously same squadron, B squadron. And he says this: "This lieutenant was a bit of a death or glory boy. We were going into an orchard, seemed like it, a lot of trees, I can remember. Hearing over the intercom, one of the fellows inside the turret, 'Get your head down!' But he didn't take any notice of him. And then suddenly they're hit. And once again, you're Jack Edwards."
I was looking through the periscope, seeing what I could see. There was a big explosion behind me, somewhere at the back of the tank. So I turned round and I saw that the turret seemed to be full of flames. I did my very quick draw on the fire extinguisher and started spraying where the flames were coming from. They eased off somewhat. Amazing. I think they were coming through the engine bulkhead. I guess something had hit us at the rear end of the tank. I guessed it was a bazooka. All the crew had disappeared except for Lieutenant Munro, who was slumped over the back of the gunner's seat. I leaned over to have a look at him, and I thought, well, he must be dead, because his blood was spattered all over the gun shield. He had a big hole through his neck, but it wasn't bleeding. I thought, if it's not bleeding now, he must be dead.
Now, the driver, Cliff Pember, he's only got one thought in his mind. These quotes just link together not perfectly, because it's at 70 years later, but it's amazing, this sequence of quotes. He's only got one thought on his mind. Guess what that is?
Well, to get out of the tank as soon as physically possible. He's only human.
Yeah, who can blame him? And Cliff Pember says this: "When the tank caught on fire, I really didn't know what happened. I thought we'd got hit by a bazooka and the turret crew had been killed. The amount of flames that was coming out of there. The only thing I was concerned about was getting out. I couldn't get out of the escape hatch at all." That's the one through the bottom. And he says that there was not enough ground clearance. "I couldn't get out of my hatch because the gun was over it. All I could see was smoke in the turret. I said to Viv Holden, 'Get out, Viv.' He wouldn't get out. So I went over the top of him and out, down by the side of the tank." Now, this Viv, he's worried about, because if you get out of the tank, you get shot by the Germans who've just bazookaed you. So that's what he's worried about. So what happens?
Well, Holden does jump out of the tank.
After Pember.
But as he did so, he was badly hit. And Trooper Cliff Pember goes on to say this:
"Viv got out and a sniper got him right up the back. Must have got him as he turned round to jump down. I got Viv round by the side of me, and every time he groaned, you could hear a burst of machine gun fire coming like that. Brrrt! There's a tow bar on the side of the tank. So I got on top of the bogey, I'm hanging on there. There I was. Every time old Viv was groaning, the machine gun bullets were coming. I was all right, keeping my feet off the ground." So he's just clinging on, above.
Now, Edwards was still in the Sherman. His only thought was to get away from the hedge and any German infantry that might be lurking there. And this is what Trooper Jack Edwards says: "The turret happened to be in the right direction, so I could wriggle through into the driver's seat. I started reversing. I thought, I'll try and get a bit further away from the hedge before I get out. Taffy Pember, who was outside, shouts, 'Stop! Stop!' I stopped and he said, 'Viv's hurt and you're taking the tank away from him. We've been shot at as we bailed out. Get out anyway, because the tank's on fire,' which I knew. I said, 1, two, three, and I shot out like a streak of lightning onto the ground outside.
Now, I quite like headwinds because we like irritable people, and he's got a totally irrational thing going on in his head. He's annoyed, and he's annoyed. Who's he annoyed with?
Well, he's annoyed at the actions of the now deceased Lieutenant Munro in putting him into danger, at Viv Holden for being wounded, and himself.
So he's just generally irritated. So be irritable, Gary, as Jack Edwards.
I looked around and I felt quite annoyed because our tank was there on its own and the rest of the troop were about 100 yards or more behind us. And we were there poking about in this hedge all on our own. There was Taffy and myself behind the tank. I was also annoyed at Viv Holden lying on the ground, pretending to be badly hurt. I couldn't see any blood coming out of him. And I was annoyed at myself because I thought, if I had just thought on, I could have brought some smoke grenades or something out.
So when he jumped out, he should have picked up some smoke grenades. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Now, at this point, there's no sign, you'll notice, of the gunner. We've talked about everybody else in the crew, but not the gunner. What's happened to him?
Well, they found out later he jumped out and simply run like hell to get away as far as he and as quickly as possible.
Now, I want to make this clear. People might say, well, this isn't exactly fitting together. Well, of course it's not. It's because this is incredibly dramatic and exciting. It's all happening in a matter of seconds. And of course it doesn't fit exactly. But what a picture we're getting of what it's like, eh? Anyway, so he's gone. Now, the two remaining survivors, that's Jack Edwards and Pemba, they try and tend to Viv Holden's wounds. And you're going to continue as Jack Edwards.
Taffy says, let's have a look at Viv. I got Viv's field dressing out of his pocket and between us, we started taking his jacket off. We got it half off and still couldn't see any sign of blood. Just then, there was a long burst of machine gun fire came under the tank. Viv shouts, Margaret, darling, I love you. Goodbye. I said, Taffy, they've got me in the legs. He said, they got me in the legs as well. Lots of wounds over both legs. They weren't bullet holes. They were bits of ricochet, bits of rock shot up from the ground and all sorts. The legs were riddled, wounds all over them. I sat down with my back to one of the bogies. I still had this field dressing in my hand. There is actually two dressings in one, so I used one on the worst wound on one leg and one on the worst wound on the other leg.
Now, a sad little thing as to that was that I looked it up and his wife wasn't called Margaret. And that's not funny. It's just that's not a bit of funny business. That will be he's misremembered the name that said, almost certainly. Or the, yeah. But again, poor old Viv Holden. And that's... anyway, where are we now then?
Well, it seemed hopeless. But then their hopes of rescue were briefly raised. And Jack Edwards says this. While I'm doing this, the troop Firefly arrives and stops nearby. The sergeant shouts, get on the back of my tank. I thought, we haven't got a lot of chance of that. He'd no sooner said it when I saw something come over from behind the hedge, shot over, and it just missed the front of this Firefly, and it exploded somewhere in the space between the Firefly and us. Terrific bang. The Firefly went smartly into reverse and got out of it. This explosion shot up a big cloud of smoke and dust. Viv Holden was lying on the ground. He made the most piercing scream and he came completely off the ground, umpteen feet in the air, and then dropped back again. I presumed he was dead or too far gone to worry about. I saw this cloud of smoke and dust and thought, that'll give us cover. Hurry, let's get out of here. I said, come on, Taff. We both staggered to some rocks about 25 yards away. Not very big ones, but we dropped behind them, then started to crawl to the other side of the field. It wasn't a very big field.
Now, just a bit of explanation. A Firefly, as many of our listeners will remember, is the 17-pounder version of the Sherman. And a bit more about the death of Viv Holden. Well, he must have been wounded a load of times by now. I feel very sorry for Viv Holden. Presumably that was another bazooka shot that had disturbed the Firefly.
Or a Panzerfaust.
It's a Panzerfaust. You are so technically correct these days. Anyway, Jack Edwards, they've both been wounded badly by this time, in a sense. They try their best to get away. They're running back. And again, you're Jack Edwards.
I'm doing everything.
You are doing everything. Not as much as Jack Edwards did in 1944, Gary.
That's true. Jack Edwards. We both crawled across the field and got to a hedge at the other side. There was an infantry patrol hiding behind the hedge. One of them showed his face in a gap and said, This way, mate. We crawled through the gap he'd indicated. The other side of the hedge, I tried to stand up to walk, and I couldn't. Just fell on the ground. We both settled down on a grassy bank the other side of the hedge. The infantry disappeared. The tanks moved off. It was just very quiet, and it went dark. An infantry medical corporal arrived. He looked at us, cut our trouser legs off, and did a good bandaging job on us. I put dressings on, but they'd dragged off as I'd been crawling. Whether it was the wounds or the shock or loss of blood or what, I don't know. I just felt tired. I could have gone to sleep. I was at peace with the world.
Now, the medical corporal disappears, but he's only gone to get a stretcher. He comes back and with another stretcher bearer, and they take Cliff Pember, that's Taffy. I think he might be from Wales. I missed a chance there, but this is too, no silly accent, so it's too serious. And then they come back for Jack Edwards. But by then it's pitch dark and he's carried back to the scissor bridge we mentioned earlier across the river. And it's about 600 yards that they're carried back. Bigger boy, that's quite heavy. And then taken in a scout car right to a proper dressing station. And here, who does he meet there, Gary?
Well, he has a brief reunion with his gunner who'd got away, but was being treated for burns to his hands. Both would be evacuated back to the UK for more prolonged hospital treatment. Behind Edwards and Pember, the German resistance had soon ended.
Yeah, this is the pattern of the fighting in the Bocage, isn't it, Gary? We've talked about it. So you get a spasm of machine gun fire, a splatter of mortars or Nebelwerfers. You get shots from the deadly Panzerfaust. Or you might get a Panzer, an actual Mark IV, or a Tiger, Gary. They're all Tigers, aren't they? Or a Panther. Or it might be one of the self-propelled guns, the Stugs. But that they don't tend to hold long, do they?
No, hold-ups were frequent, but progress continued. Overall, it was evident that the Germans were staggering.
Staggering.
Falaise fell on the 16th of August, and over the next few days, the Falaise gap was closed, although several of the German divisions had either slipped through or forced their way out before it was finally sealed on the 21st of August.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. 50,000 men, Gary, of the German 7th Army are made POWs. And although 50,000 escaped, they'd left much of their heavy equipment. They'd left behind some 10,000 dead. Their roads were blocked with wrecked vehicles, hordes of dead horses. And what does a German logistics system depend on?
Well, it relies almost entirely on horses, not dead ones, though.
No, not dead ones. But the interesting thing is, and when people say the British Army in the First World War, 1918, is based on lorries, not on horses. There's a point.
So the Battle of Normandy was finally over, and it had ended in a crushing defeat for the Germans. Now it was time for an almost unopposed advance to the Seine River. And at this point, we'll take a short break.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLL and branch.com today Exclusions apply. See site for details.
On the 22nd of August, they continued to push to the east, coping with the threats of heavily mined roads, often blocked with lines of felled trees.
So you're getting little frustrating delays. I suppose you often have to wait for the Royal Engineers, the sappers, to come forward, clear away. But not so much direct German opposition, would you say?
No, and the 2nd, 5th and 4th Fire Yeomanry, along with the rest of the 11th Armour Division, were then given a few days' hard-earned rest.
And not just rest, is it? Because what else is happening during any of these rest periods?
Well, new officers and reinforcement drafts arrived to replenish their ranks. The men were growing accustomed to new faces.
Yeah, you've got to remember that Goodwood was only sort of four weeks before. This is all happening, very concentrated period. First action was Epsom. Wow.
Now, on the 28th of August, they sprang back into life with the 11th Armoured Division, now assigned as part of 30 Corps, recently reinvigorated under the energetic command style of Lieutenant General Brian Horrocks.
When I was young, he used to be on the TV.
I think I remember him, yeah.
He was famous for being able to speak without notes and things. Now, they're galloping in their tanks. Da-da-da. This is real cavalry-style stuff, isn't it? What are they doing? They're pushing through to the Seine. They cross at the town of Vernon. What is going on? What's happening?
Well, this is part of Montgomery's mission for the 21st Army Group, to push northwards and destroy the remaining German forces in northeast France and Belgium. He intended to secure the vital channel ports in the Pas-de-Calais area and the Belgian airfields essential to maintain aerial domination.
What's the next really big objective, would you say then, Gary? Speaking as we've established, the international expert on Normandy and the campaign.
Yes. That will be Antwerp.
It's not in Normandy, is it?
No. So that would be Antwerp.
Yeah, the well-known port of Normandy.
Yeah, now that offered a potential shortcut to their ever-lengthening lines of communication and supply, which was going all the way back to...
Normandy!
Yes.
Yeah, of course. So it is important, Antwerp, isn't it?
Yeah, now once this had been achieved, Montgomery planned to thrust eastward into the Ruhr, heartland of Germany.
Ooh, now something's happening though, isn't it? There's a bit of a change in... explain to me what exactly is going on.
Well, yeah, as in the next couple of days, there's going to be a change in his status, and the Supreme Allied Commander, Dwight D. Eisenhower, took direct overall control of operations.
I want to point out, you deliberately put that
put D
that
in, yes.
Because you know I hate Americans doing that.
Yes.
Hello, American listeners. We love you all.
You just put that he's Dwight Eisenhower.
Yes, bugger his middle
name. But I put the D in. Yeah. Now, this is done to reflect the increasing importance and size of the American element in the Allied armies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're playing an incredibly important role now, they need you. So Montgomery, what is he still commanding 21st Army Group? I think he is, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's no longer the man who set the perimeters of future operations. But he would be working as an equal alongside General Omar Bradley, commanding the 12th Army
Group.
What's
his initial?
Commanding the 12th Army Group and under the overall command of Eisenhower. Now, Bradley had actually reported into Montgomery up until this point.
It's a change in status, but it's reflecting that the development of the campaign and the American, increasing importance to the Americans. Do you think Montgomery, a well-known, passive, quiet, modest individual?
So you're making reference to the somewhat prickly and arrogant Montgomery finding it difficult to accept. But he was given some minor compensation as he was promoted to Field Marshal on the 29th of August.
Yeah, and I mean, Montgomery's always a difficult subordinate, but he continues to play an important role. But now in the debate over Allied strategy, he's no longer setting it, is he? He's not, or grand tactics, if you prefer. He's no longer setting everything. He's now merely submitting to higher authority, which is Eisenhower.
Yeah, but he is involved in those discussions.
He is.
Now, the 30th of August would live in many of the men's memories as it proved to be truly a hard day's night.
Oh, see what I did there?
Yeah. First, they made the journey to Hettemesnil, meeting little opposition, although en route, they got the chance to shoot up a convoy of German vehicles and securing several prisoners.
Now, by this time, so during, they're already done 40-mile advance, and what do you think happens to tanks after about 40 miles?
Well, some of them had already run short of petrol. Now, in the normal course of events, they would have lagered at Hettermesnil, but instead, they received orders to push on overnight all the way to Amiens in the Somme area.
Yeah. Now, this is the Horrocks. We said he was a bit of a live wire.
No, it's true.
It is true.
It's not Horrocks.
It's Ray making me genuinely laugh. No, sorry. This is General Horrocks.
Ah.
And he thought that there was so little resistance that the 11th Armoured Division could press on pilots, so to speak, regardless, at night. Now, what do they normally do at night?
Well, they normally lager, as was mentioned, but the idea was that they might totally surprise the Germans and bounce them out of Amiens before the bridges over the Somme were demolished.
Yeah, absolutely. So the officers of 2nd 545, they're caught on the hop because they're not expecting this. News of an all-night advance was probably the last thing they wanted to hear. And I'm going to be Lieutenant William, or he doesn't use that much, but Lieutenant Steele Brownie, commanding 4 Troop A Squadron. And he says this, "All I wanted was sleep, but had to await orders for the next day. When they came, we were flabbergasted, for we were to move at once and drive through the night to Amiens. I don't know if Corps Commander Horrocks actually said, 'There's a moon tonight,' but he did write later that this was a curious way to employ an armoured division. If he had been in Hettermesnil, that place that you mentioned, Gary, he would have heard similar opinions expressed more bluntly. 30 miles in the dark, can't see to fire, can't hear, who's reading a map, we had problems." He also wrote later, "It has a shattering effect on the morale of the enemy to wake up in the morning and find that some hundreds of tanks have penetrated deep into their positions under cover of darkness." True. So he can see what's got... He doesn't want to do it. He can see the problems, Ken Steele Brownlee, but he accepts that it might be worth it.
The advance was a sound tactical vision, perhaps, but one hell of an undertaking in practice. They would be travelling in the pitch dark on minor twisting roads with multiple junctions on an unreconnoitred route. The one saving grace was that there was minimal German opposition. And you're going to tell us what Lance Corporal Roy Valance, who was in 4 Troop A Squadron, says.
"We were to replenish, bomb up and continue advancing all through the night. Extremely unusual. The first time this had ever happened. The opposition at this stage was comparatively light. We all thought it was a jolly good thing. We could Steele Brownie didn't, but yeah. We could see the end of the war almost in sight. We started off at about 6 in the evening. We were just told to keep nose to tail, keep in touch with the vehicle in front, and we wouldn't lose the way in the dark. Quite late in the evening, the column was stopped. And after a while, I became suspicious as to why we were stopped for such a long time. I walked ahead and found that all the crew in the tank in front of me, from another troop, was sound asleep. And there was not a vehicle in sight in front of them. I knocked them up, went back to my tank, overtook that tank, and just swanned on in the dark, hoping I would catch up. Needless to say, we did." Well, not necessarily needless to say, is it? But now, who's at front of the whole column?
Well, that was Corporal Byram, who seemed to be able to see and map read in the dark, as his performance was much complimented in the regimental history. "He made scarcely a single mistake."
Well, Gary, I think you, as John Buchanan, 4 Troop A Squadron, have a different perspective but slightly more jaundiced perspective of Burns. Or however you pronounce that name, Burns' performance that night. Go on, John Buchanan.
"This is what we were geared up for, the breakthrough. Somebody punched a hole and we went through it. Our chance came and we weren't going to miss it, even day and night. You had to follow the tank in front. There was only a wee light to follow. You couldn't put your headlights on. More or less nose to tail. One laugh was the lead tank. The boy must have been bamboozled. Instead of turning right, he went straight into this field. Of course, the whole British Army followed him. We were actually kind of sleepy then, and everybody followed him. He went round in a circle in this field and came out. It took a wee while to sort ourselves out.
In many ways, this is an army thing. If you're driving in a column behind a leader, no effective lights. It's more difficult than being in front. You must remember this from when you were in the army. There's a well-known military phenomenon.
I think you're referring to the fact that even if the front vehicles are going at a reasonable speed, then those at the back of the column will have difficulty in keeping up.
It's strange how that works, isn't it?
Well, it also happens on foot. Yeah, it's not just vehicles. But worst of all, what could be worse? The men are exhausted.
Tidy.
Indeed, some resorted to taking their Benzedrine tablets to try and stay awake.
Speed.
Some of them resorted to taking their Benzedrine tablets.
That's how they spoke afterwards. Ah, oh, I remember the world of rock and roll. There were lots of people who smoked like that. Anyway, not me. I like beer.
Now, over this madcap advance, it was inevitable that more and more tanks would run out of petrol and they'd be left behind by the wayside. Now, however, some of the crews found it an absolute benefit to be momentarily out of the war.
Yeah, waiting for the fuel lorries to catch up with them. Because the lorries, of course, the B echelon, are following up with the fuel. Why might that be? Well, it's because if they stopped, and they often did run out of petrol in a village, what would happen?
Well, when the villagers woke up, they gave them a great reception. And this is Trooper Ron Forbes, as well of 4 Troop. Sorry, B-Squadron, you're quite right to correct me. Thank you, Peter. I admonish myself. Bertie Moir had red hair. That sounds like a song. Bertie Moir had red hair. We got into this village and suddenly we ran out of petrol. We were lucky to stop in a village. Some fellows ran out in the wide open. The villagers came out full of the joys of spring, and there was one red-haired girl attached herself to Bertie Moir. I think he fell in love with her. The most enjoyable thing of the whole war was seeing these delighted people coming out and kissing you and whatnot. Buried wine emerged from gardens. Some of it was too mature for us. We were warned not to get ourselves too inebriated because we wouldn't be fit for duty. The column eventually caught up. And that's reminding me of the stories of the Great War, where they were marching through villages and drinking wine and beer and becoming completely sozzled.
I love the idea of Bertie Moir. Moir. And he's red-haired floozy.
That does sound like a song, doesn't it? Right. Like a football chant. Bertie Moir has got red hair. Now, as the tanks neared Amiens...
Come the dawn, Gary.
It was evident that the Germans had indeed been taken totally by surprise, and several vehicles were shot up.
Even more important was the capture, in a sense, of in Amiens, of General Heinrich Eberbach. Who's he, Gary? Go on, who's he?
Well, he'd just been promoted to command what remained of the German 7th Army. Lieutenant Hudson, as the intelligence officer, was ordered to take Eberbach back to be interrogated. And his driver, Ken Watson, remembered it well. And this is Lance Corporal Ken Watson of HQ Squadron.
When they captured the German General Eberbach, we had to take him back to brigade headquarters. He was a very surly sort of gentleman. We had him right in the back of the scout car. This guy's got a scout car, it's not a tank. Although I think he had his legs inside. I saw 3 Germans running across the road into the woods. I said to this German general, tell those men to come out here and get on the back of this scout car. So he did. He spoke English in a broken fashion. These men came out, jumped onto the backer, and their eyes popped out of the head when they saw the German general. We went across this railway line, and I saw a German walking along with his helmet in his hands. We stopped him. I got out of the scout car and had a look. In his helmet, he had 6 eggs, which I said were mine, and told him to jump on the back of the scout car. We delivered the German general to brigade headquarters. He didn't say goodbye. And I like the idea of all these people being tricked into getting in, being prisoners. And then when he got back to the headquarters of 11th Armoured Division, they were extremely rude to Eberbach. You'll be shocked to know as well. So what's happening now?
Well, by 11 o'clock on the 31st of August, the 2 main bridges over the Somme River had been captured and Amiens was secure. The Germans were in chaos throughout the whole area. After a brief rest on the 1st of September, the mad advance continues, pushing across the Somme and on to Aubigny. And you're going to tell us what Major General Philip, or Pip, Roberts of HQ 11th Armoured Division said.
There we were, just rattling along through places with names like Amiens, Somme, Ypres and so on, which had become horrifying legends only 25 years earlier, where hundreds of thousands of men, millions even on both sides, slogging it out in muddy trench warfare, had perished. All that ghastly business of going over the top, the barbed wire, the machine gun fire, and yet here we were, just driving through those places.
Yeah, we've said this before, haven't we, about the road through Europe. These place names come up again and again.
Again and again and again.
Now, in the absence of serious German opposition, the 11th Armoured Division were directed to advance on the great Belgian port of Antwerp. Now, Jack Rex remembered one incident that provided him and his crew with a great deal of amusement at the expense of a somewhat pompous German officer. And this is Trooper Jack Rex of HQ Squadron, 2nd Fife and 4 Fire Yeomanry.
Going through a village, an old French woman stopped us. She said, "There's a German officer who wants to give himself up." Me and a pal of mine, we went upstairs and he was sat in bed. His hat was on the chair and his tunic on the chair back with all these fancy decorations. He said to me in perfect English, "And what rank are you to?" "Why?" "Well, I want to give myself up to someone of my own rank." Well, this lad came from Dundee. He was a real hard nut. He reached by me, grabbed this German officer by the scruff of the neck, threw him downstairs and threw all his clothes through the window out into the street. All the French people were stood in a ring round him while he was putting his trousers on. Jock said to me, "The bagger, who does he think he is?"
Yeah, well, probably Richtofen by the sound of your accent. The advance for the next couple of days blurred into a roll call of French villages and towns. The occasional skirmish was all that marred their steady progress.
Yeah, the French generally overjoyed to see them, but there's one aspect, as they go through these villages, the towns, that the soldiers don't like. One aspect about liberation, I suppose. What do you think that might be, Gary?
I think you're referring to the treatment by members of the French resistance of female collaborators.
Not male collaborators, female collaborators. That's what I notice. And you're going to be Trooper John Buchanan, 4 Troop A Squadron.
It's a shame, really. They grabbed the women and put them out in the middle of the street, sat them in a chair, tied their hands behind their back, and then shaved all their hair off because they'd been doing with the Germans, collaborating. But I think I felt kind of sad at that, because no matter who you are, the first 6 weeks you might hate them, but you've got to live with them. Nature takes its course. These Germans, some of them nice blondarians. If you're hungry, you'll do anything. They couldn't help themselves.
And I think that's a reasonable perspective of what's happening. It was sad. On 3rd of September 1944, the regiment's following up behind the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment.
Very easy to say.
What do you know?
Royal Tank Regiment.
Third RTR.
Oh, that's even easier to say. Now, they join them to overcome some stiff resistance at Seclin, moving round to the right of the town, while the 3rd RTR attacked from the left. Shortly afterwards, they crossed the border into Belgium to scenes of great rejoicing. However, they were soon made aware that the Belgian people were starving. And this is Trooper Jeff Eason of the Recce Troop HQ Squadron.
These four horses had got caught up in the crossfire and got themselves shot. They were lying in the road. As soon as the last shot died away, all the civvies rushed out, and in less than 10 minutes, all that was left was a pile of hooves. Never seen anything so quick. There was just a pile of steaming hooves. In other words, horse meat. We'll have that.
Many of the men remembered this rapid advance as a golden period of their wartime experiences. A sense of their collective achievement, the welcome from the civilians, and the absence of serious fighting contributed to this. And once more, you're going to be Lance Corporal Roy Valance of 4 Troop A Squadron.
The days were full. One started at first light and didn't go into lager until last light. And then you had to bomb up and fill up with petrol. You got very little sleep. We were exhilarated. We thought everything was going well. We were winning the war. It was going to be over. Casualties at this stage were very light. We didn't mind at all. I was 21, 22 years old. It was a great adventure.
I bet it was, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It was just a golden period. When, you know, they're not getting killed. They're doing everything you could do. Yeah.
Still, they pushed on until they reached Antwerp on the 4th of September. That was the real target. It was essential to capture the port and its logistical infrastructure intact, as the British supply lines were severely overstretched, reaching as they did all the way back to far off...
Normandy. How far's that, Gary? Exactly.
Well, indeed. Since they'd crossed the Seine, they'd advanced some 340 miles.
That's after the Seine. So wow, it's a long, long way. Now, most of the... what do you think about this? I mean, most of the German... the much-vaunted Blitzkrieg of May 1940. What's happened to all those...
Well, they've all been reclaimed. It's a magnificent achievement by the 11th Armoured Division as a whole.
Now, on entering the city, the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry... Third Royal Tank Regiment, never mind. Were deployed alongside 159 Brigade. What are they doing?
They're clearing up the remaining pockets of German resistance in the city. Now, that's quite a tricky business, as Lance Corporal Roy Valance goes on to say.
On the outskirts of Antwerp, we were met by huge crowds of people, cheering us on, pressing drinks on us. We were in one street, being mobbed, and then we were told to advance, which we did with difficulty, because of all the civilians all over the tanks. Can't run them over, can you? They're on our side. Anyway, he says, we went round the corner and there was hardly a soul in sight and we were fired upon immediately. The contrast was enormous. We were being sniped from a large factory building. I put an HE, high explosive, shell through every window in the side of the factory that was looking at us.
What a contrast. You know, think about that.
Yeah.
We're in this street and we've got civilians all over the tank. Go round the corner. Fired upon.
Bang. Yeah.
Now, the British found that the Antwerp docks were almost undamaged, which, given their obvious value to the British, seemed to indicate how the sheer speed of the advance had indeed wrong-footed the Germans.
Now, there was some resistance, Gary. You mustn't overlook the minor resistance. That was centred around Central Park. Now, why was there a problem there?
Well, the Germans had built a system of linked concrete pillboxes and deep dugouts.
Did it work?
Well, no. I mean, the presence of the C Squadron tanks seems to have intimidated the garrison, who surrendered after a short exchange of fire.
Yeah, so they knew they couldn't win. They have a few shots, yeah. Give up.
The regiment was in a lager to the south of Antwerp, where much valuable maintenance and repair work was carried out over the next couple of days.
They need that, because after an advance like that, these mechanical things, things go wrong. Yeah, have they got any duties to perform otherwise?
Absolutely. There were still tank patrols sent out into the city. Guards were set up on possible canal crossings. And there was also a brief abortive attempt to cross the Meuse-Escaut Canal to the north of the city.
That didn't really work, did it? Because they got a bit of a bridge here, but it was just way too... insecure to you need a proper bridgehead, and they abandoned it. What do you notice about as they're moving into Belgium, as they're approaching the Meuse-Escaut Canal? What do you, Gary, notice?
Well, I noticed that the German resistance had at last begun to stiffen. They are getting more and more resistance as they're progressing nearer and nearer Germany.
Is the war not going to end in 1944 then?
We'll have to wait and see, Pete.
I'm quite excited about the whole thing.
You're just excitable, Pete.
If you want to know more, you can always buy my book, which is called...
Burning Steel.
Yeah, it's great. Well, I like it.
You're not biased, are you?
I am biased. All right. Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit
blah.
www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?